inviting Ukraine to NATO, Russia would have no choice down the road but to intervene because this was such a grave threat to Russia. So we deliberately provoked this conflict. Then in 2014, we instigated a coup against the constitutionally elected government of Viktor Yanukovych, then the president of Ukraine, and we replaced him with hand-picked politicians that were picked by us. We got rid of the people's representative, and we put our hand-picked representatives, who were in close alliance with the far-right political wing of Ukraine, Ukrainian nationalism, that had embraced the odious ideology of a guy named Stepan Bandera, a Nazi, a guy with the blood of tens of thousands of Jews on his hands, hundreds of thousands of Poles, 200,000 Russians. This is a mass murderer, and he's openly worshipped by these far right. Today, he's the national hero of Ukraine. The Ukrainian armed forces sing ballads to his honor. Children are taught from a very early age that this is the man they should, and his ideology should inspire. So Ukraine is literally a neo-Nazi nation. In 2014, we brought this Frankenstein monster to life. Now there was a conflict. One of the things that these neo-Nazis do, they view the Russians, and this is important for people to understand, they view the Russians as subhumans. They call them Moskal, which is sort of a slang for Moscow, but it's not just a slang. It's the equivalent of the N-word. Let me just put it that way. A word you don't, no one wants to hear, because we all know that it doesn't mean anything good. And that's the term that the Ukrainians use. They call them orcs. They're subhumans. They treat the Russians as subhumans. And in April of 2014, these neo-Nazis that we empowered passed a law basically declaring war on the ethnic Russians of Ukraine. And this led to a civil conflict that led to a need for the international community to come together to bring it to an end. This was called the Minsk Accords, a treaty or a ceasefire agreement that was negotiated by France, Germany, and Ukraine with Russia as an observer to bring an end to the conflict. But there were things that had to happen. The Ukrainian government had to undo those laws that outlawed ethnic Russians, that they had to grant autonomy to the ethnic Russians so that they could practice their religion, speak their language, do their culture. All of that had been outlawed by the Ukrainians prior to that. And in exchange, the ethnic Russians said, "We will continue to live within the territory. We will respect the territorial integrity of Ukraine." So for anybody who sits there and says Russia was always planning on doing this, always planning on taking, no. Russia bought into this. And from 2014 on, Russia was insisting that the Minsk Accords be implemented. But it was Ukraine, Germany, and France who have now come clean. The president of Ukraine at the time, Petro Poroshenko, the German chancellor who negotiated, Angela Merkel, and the French president, Hollande, have all acknowledged that the Minsk Accords was a sham designed to buy time so that the United States and NATO could train a Ukrainian army that would be able to take over the ethnic Russian territories to defeat the terrorists that they called. And they did. The United States built a military facility in Western Ukraine where every 55 days we trained one battalion, 500 to 700 Ukrainian troops, to go off and kill Russians in East Ukraine. Russia begged for Minsk to be implemented. It wouldn't be implemented. And now Russia facing 60 to 90,000 NATO-trained Ukrainian troops that are ready to launch an attack on the ethnic Russians of the Donbas region and then move on to Crimea. Russia carried out what is known as preemptive collective self-defense, that together with Lugansk and Donetsk, the two ethnic Russian republics that had declared themselves independent, Russia recognized it, formed a collective security agreement. They carried out preemptive self-defense. You and I know this concept. We both understand. I just can't come up and punch you in the face. I mean, first of all, it'd be a foolish move on my part because you probably kicked my butt. But let's say I thought that I could take you. So I come to you and I just out of the blue, bam, hit you in the face. That's me assaulting you. I'm in the wrong. But now you're watching me and I'm training every day in my front yard, hitting a bag, looking over and going, "Hey, I'm going to come over and I'm going to punch you in the face with this fist right here. Boom, boom, boom." And I keep telling you, "I'm going to hit you." And then I walk up to you and I cock that fist back. Guess what you get to do? Pop, put me down. preemptive self-defense. You don't have to wait for me to hit you. You, seeing an imminent threat, get to preempt it. That's what Russia did on February 24th. Preemptive collective self-defense in the interest of protecting the ethnic Russians of Donetsk and Donbass, recognizing there were 60 to 90,000 NATO-trained Ukrainian forces ready to launch an attack, Russia preempted it by attacking. But under Article 51 of the United Nations Charter, Russia is permitted to do this. So everybody out there saying that this is an unprovoked act of aggression by Russia just simply doesn't know the history. The history is quite clear. So now Russia did this, but they came in soft because Russia doesn't want to go to war against the Ukrainians. They didn't want to do this. They view the Ukrainians as their brothers. You know, here in the West, in the United States, we don't understand it. We bought into the propaganda. We're like, no, them Russians hate them Ukrainians. They just want to fight and all that stuff. That's just not true. This war is breaking the heart and soul of the Russian people because they view the Ukrainian people as their brothers. They don't have a problem with the Ukrainian people. They have a problem with the Nazis that we've empowered. And remember, when I say Nazis, I really mean it. These are Nazis. These aren't wannabes. These aren't fakes. I mean, just imagine if people paraded down the streets of the United States wearing the robes of the Ku Klux Klan, burning the cross with all the symbology of it. And I said, those are Klansmen. They go, no, they're not. Those aren't Klansmen. You can't call them. Sure, I can. That's the KKK. They look like a duck, walk like a duck, quack like a duck. They are a duck. The Ukrainians are Nazis, the Ukrainian government. And, you know, this is just an outright statement of fact. So, you know, there's a war against these Nazis going on. Russia is against them, but they're not against the Ukrainian people. And again, how Russia promoted peace. Russia was pushing for a negotiated settlement almost immediately after this war began. The war began on February 24th. By March 3rd, the Russians were already engaged in, I think even earlier than that, were engaged in negotiations to bring this conflict to an end. They had three negotiations between early March and March 6th that set down the conditions. On April 1st, they were scheduled to meet in Istanbul for a final peace agreement, that an agreement would be signed. And part of that, to set that agreement up, Russia carried out what was called a confidence building measure. They withdrew from huge amounts of Ukrainian territory, saying, see, we're not here to take your territory. We're withdrawing. Now let's sign the peace treaty. And what happened? The United States and NATO bullied the Ukrainians into backing out. In fact, the Ukrainian head of the Ukrainian intelligence service has pretty much said, we weren't negotiating in good faith. This was just designed to buy time. For what? Well, what happened in May? NATO, the United States, voted a new Lend-Lease Act, $40 billion worth of American taxpayer money used for military assistance, where we enabled the Ukrainians to build up a new military. And then they attacked the Russians. And they had some success. They drove the Russians out of Kharkov. They captured the right bank of Kherson. But in doing so, they changed the nature of the conflict. This stopped being Russia versus Ukraine. And this became Russia versus NATO. And now, FAFO. Fool around, find out. You know, there's an old Russian saying, and I butcher it sometimes. I've had my Russian friends correct me. But the Russians are slow to harness, but fast to ride. And what that means is, just imagine you got some big old stallion in the field, and you want to get moving, but he don't want to play. He wants to eat grass, chase mares, do whatever stallions do. Okay, but it takes you a little bit of time to put the harness on him. He's fighting, yeah, he's struggling, doesn't want to do it. But now you got the harness on, he's ready to rock. He's going to take you down that road. The Russians didn't want to put on the harness of war. They didn't want this. They had a limited objective, a special military operation, but NATO and Ukraine turned it into the NATO conflict that Russia was trying to avoid from the very beginning, since the Minsk Accords. Now Russia's harnessed, and they're going for a ride. And that ride is this offensive. 300,000 men were mobilized. Another 180,000 so volunteers were brought in and trained. Some of the most modern equipment coming out of Russian factories has been used to equip these forces. Meanwhile, this NATO-Ukrainian army has been ground down into nothing. I mean, some of the death figures coming out are just mind-boggling. Let's just remind your audience, in the 10 years of Vietnam, we lost some 58,000 Americans, and it broke our heart, broke our spirit. 58,000 in 10 years. During the height of the Vietnam conflict, we were suffering, say, 200, 220 dead a week. And it crushed us as a nation. Ukrainians in less than a year have suffered anywhere ranging from 157,000 dead to over 300,000 dead. In the entire World War II, America lost 300,000 dead. The entire World War II, that's against Nazi Germany, Imperial Japan, and everything else in between, 300,000 dead. Ukrainians probably have lost that or more in less than a year in fighting against the Russians. If this doesn't break your heart, nothing will. Now, the Russians are engaged in this conflict too. Normally, your casualty ratios in militaries, let's take a look at, let's say, Germany versus the United States in World War II or Germany versus the Soviet Union. Your casualty ratios tended to be about 1 to 1.2, 1 to 1.3, meaning that the winning side is suffering 1, the losing side suffering 1.2, 1.3. So in a war of attrition, you grind them down, and the side that's suffering less casualties tends to win. The Russians right now are enjoying, more than a 10 to 1 advantage in terms of death ratio. So, you know, we're talking, maybe the Russians have suffered 20, 30,000 dead. Guys, that's a lot. Let's just break that down for a second. 20 to 30,000 dead in a year. That's 3,000 a month, or maybe a little less than 3,000 a month. And then we roll into what that constitutes in a week. The Russians are suffering three times as many dead per week than we suffered during the height of the Vietnam War. And the casualties we suffered broke us as a nation. Russia today is suffering three times as many casualties as that, and the Ukrainians are suffering 10 times as many casualties as that. So everybody who's sitting here talking about, oh, that Russian-Ukrainian war is sort of an abstract, guys are dying. And it's the most vicious kind of death. There's nothing, this ain't Hollywood. This ain't, oh, I got shot. I'm going to die and give a little speech before I die and everybody will cry. This is bodies being blown apart, guts pouring out, bodies burning, heads being decapitated, arms torn off, bleeding out. The worst things that you could imagine is happening every single day. Hundreds of people are dying. Civilians are starving. Infrastructure is being destroyed. And yet, this war ain't over. It's going to end soon. When I say soon, it's going to end sometime this year. But for it to end, those 300,000 Russian troops that have been mobilized are going to have to be committed to this battle. And that's happening now. Some people believe, including myself, that the offensive has already begun. You know, the Russians, they've never been good about explaining their war to us because it's not their job. That's why people like me and you and others are out there trying to guess what's going on. You know, hey, what's going on? I don't know. The Kremlin didn't call me this morning and give me the update. So I have to look at all the news and sort of, make guesswork. But my guesswork right now is that the offensive has already begun. It's going to continue to increase and escalate. And the level of violence is going to blow out of proportion. But that's where they're at. And here's the news flash for America. We picked the wrong side again. We started this. We supported the Ukrainians, and they're going to lose. And there's nothing we can do to change that outcome. The fact is, if we claim to care about the Ukrainian people, let me give you just a simple statement of fact. Every tank we provide the Ukrainians is a guaranteed 4 more Ukrainian dead. Every armored fighting vehicle we provide will have a squad of 7 to 11 people inside that would be blown up by the Russians. So those are more dead. We are killing Ukrainians. We are guaranteeing tens of thousands of Ukrainian deaths in an effort that cannot change the outcome. Russia is winning and Russia will win this war. And all we're doing by helping the Ukrainians is prolonging the suffering and sacrifice of that nation. There's mothers, there's sisters, there's wives, there's sons, there's uncles, there's grandparents who are losing people they love every single day in a war that didn't need to be fought and shouldn't be fought and should be brought to an end, but it won't be because the United States is yet again engaged in a policy. And you hear all people are like, well, that's not what I'm hearing from the American government. Oh, really? I wonder why. Let's go back to Afghanistan. If you remember in June and July of 2021, we were being told that we are committed. This fight is important. The Taliban and Al-Qaeda must be destroyed. We cannot retreat. This is of strategic importance. Blah, 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 blah. August, we're out. Why? Because we got beat. And this is what's happening in Ukraine now. We're We're talking, we're doing this, we're doing that, we're doing this. I'm telling you right now, come August, September, October, we're out. Why? Because we got beat. America stands for nothing. We are the worst friends in the world. If you're a friend of America, it's guaranteed you're going to suffer. Your men are going to die.
Well, if this is the case, then what ramifications does that have for NATO? And on top of that, couldn't America be charged with genocide for initiating and continuing to propagate and push this war on the Ukrainian people?
I mean, couldn't America? No. Should America? Yes. It comes down to court, you know, a matter of jurisdiction. There's no court in the world that can charge America. America can only be charged in the court of public opinion. And here's the important part, ladies and gentlemen. We are the court. We sit in judgment of our government. What are we doing about it? I firmly believe that silence is consent. So if the average American sitting there going, okay, war, that's pretty bad, but I'm just going to go on. I'm going to, you know, go live my life, go watch a movie, go eat a dinner, go, you know, play with my dogs. It's stuff I do. I'm not making fun of people. I do this. Then silence is consent. We are consenting to the actions of the American government, what they are doing in our collective name. But we are the only court that can sit in judgment of the American government. There is no court of jurisdiction around the world that can do this. And who is going to do this? The Europeans? I mean, if you want to talk about a colonial relationship, we are the colonial masters to our little European colonies. They can't do anything unless we say that. They're little, the perfect little trained poodles. Jump, sit, fetch, roll over, play dead. I mean, that's what we do to our European allies, our friends. We're not friends of anybody. We're the worst friends in the world. We only bring suffering to them. But should America be judged? Yes, yes. And that, again, I just reiterate, we are the judge. We, the people of the United States of America, we are the judge, jury, and executioners. And we get to take every single one of these people who are doing things in our name and hold them accountable on election day. It's just a matter of what our priorities are. Do we really care about genocide and mass murder and all that? I'm telling you, on election day, the answer is no. What we care about is what's in our pocket. What we care about is the paycheck. And but that means we become a consumer society, and we are all captured by the allure of the almighty dollar. And we stand for nothing except, you know, the furtherance of policies that make us comfortable. And we're all guilty of that. I'm as guilty of that as everybody else. I live in a glass house, so I don't, you know, I'm throwing stones, but I understand that my house is going down too. We are all guilty of the same thing. Some of us go through the motions more. I go through the motions. I write, I speak, etc. You know, is there more I can do? I'm trying. But it's tough to do things by yourself. You know, this is why you need a movement. You know, imagine Martin Luther King trying to do the civil rights movement by himself. He wouldn't have gotten very far. He was a powerful voice, but what made him even more powerful is the mass of people, the movement that joined him, that was able to bring about the changes. Imagine trying to bring the Vietnam War to a close, the anti-war movement, individuals by themselves, nothing, but a movement together. We need a movement today to bring an end to this madness. But America is so divided today between Republican and Democrat, between black and white. I mean, we aren't the single nation that we need to be to have this kind of movement. And anytime somebody tries to create a movement, that movement collapses in the weight of its own internal prejudices and angst and anxiety. We have something that's supposed to take place on February 19th on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, where Martin Luther King gave his famous I Have a Dream speech. We're supposed to get out there and talk about an anti-war movement, and it's falling apart because the left and the right can't agree to come together and agree on anything. The pollution of politics is destroying this thing. So, you know, yeah, I'm trying, you're trying, we're all trying, but how do we come together as a movement? I mean, you and I are talking right now. This is good. This is a good thing. You know, but what's the next step?
Yeah. I'm going to let my co-host Rashid, but I'm going to let him have a question, because I know it's burning him to ask you a question, so I'll do that. But before I do that, I also want to take the time out to wish my older brother, Christopher, happy birthday. Man, you are older than dinosaurs, so but happy birthday. Let me bring Rashid. Let me unmute this mic, because I'm trying to not have everybody talk over each other. So Rashid, go ahead. You have the floor.
Morning, Scott. You said just fine. You said in August, around September, August, it'd be over with. What do you see what the finish of it would be? What for America, what for Ukraine, and what for Europe would the outcome be?
Well, when I say over, what I mean is the fighting. I think the Ukrainian army will be destroyed by August, September, October, in that time frame. And there's a lot of people that are starting to come to that realization as well, including Volodymyr Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, who has told the Americans straight up, if your tanks aren't here by August, it's over. What does he mean by that? I think he means it's over. We should take him literally. It's too late. But that's the fighting. But there's a political side of this too. And that's the big unknown. I think that's your question. Because, you know, once the Ukrainian army is destroyed, how do we bring about not only a resolution to the political problems in Ukraine, but also the political problems that exist between NATO, Russia, the United States, and Russia? And that's going to take more time. There's a lot of healing that has to take place. There's a lot of, you know, the United States and NATO are going to have to do some deep reflection on what they have done. And unless they're willing to acknowledge that they have made mistakes, and when was the last time you heard an American president or somebody say, oh, we made a mistake? You don't get reelected by saying, I made a mistake. You get reelected by fooling the people into thinking that what you did was the right thing. We might have to have some sort of Richard Nixon type moment. If you recall back in 1973, peace with honor. You know, we're getting out of Vietnam. We won. Peace with honor. Dude, we got beat. We're running away from this fight, but no, peace with honor. So, and you know who's smart? The Russians are smart. And I think the Russians are going to give the West an opportunity to have a peace with honor moment where they get to save face and somehow walk away with this saying, yeah, we did okay, instead of running away with your tail between your legs. But how that happens, I don't know, because there are so many problems that have become manifest because of this conflict. I mean, my God, are we really relying on the compassion and humanity of the Russians to solve this problem, a problem they didn't start? Because that's what we're saying here. We're saying that Russia has to create an opportunity for the United States and NATO to save face. Could you imagine the United States and NATO, if the roles were reversed, giving Russia a chance to save face? No, we crush them. We put our foot on their throat. We grind it in. That's what we do. But here, there's a recognition that Russia's going to have to save the day. And, you know, I know that's anathema to most Americans, because they've been taught that Vladimir Putin, of course, is Voldemort, the manifestation of evil, the ultimate expression of evil in the world today. The most horrible man on the face of the earth, the brutal dictator who leads a nation of robotic automatons who have no heart, no compassion. Those Russians, you've seen their faces, you know, the stoic faces of the Russians, evil people who just want to kill you. Don't look at the girls. Don't look at the girls. They're pretty. And no, don't look at the girls. Look at the guys. Guys, girls, very pretty. I mean, confusing them Russians. Beautiful women, ugly men. What the hell? But I'm being facetious right here, because my point is, I've met the Russians. I know the Russians. And they're just like you and me. They are literally just like you and me. I can guarantee you, both Rashids, that I could take you right now, put you on an airplane, fly you to Russia, and put you in the average Russian household, and you would fall in love instantly, because they are the nicest people in the world. I can't use bad words here, but they got people that are like me, you know, jerks, idiots. You know, I've heard what people call me. I get it. I know I am. But not everybody's like me. There are actually nice people out in the world there who care about other people and want to do good things. And many of them happen to be Russians. You know, there's Maria Zakharova is the spokesperson of the Don't look at her. Pretty Russian girl. Can't do that. You got to look at the guys. They're ugly. But Maria gave a presentation the other day where she was chastising the Germans for doing the unthinkable, allowing German tanks to go to Ukraine to kill Russians. Not like that didn't work out the last time. But she talked about her grandmother. And it was a very touching speech. And it's made more touching by the fact that my my wife's father was grew up during World War II. And so when she talked about hunger, he knew hunger. They all knew hunger. They were living off of, you know, little handfuls of bread every day was their thing. Bread and water. That's it, baby. That's all you got. Everything else was to the war effort. And if you stole bread, you were executed or sent to the gulag. That's how important bread was. And she talked about her grandmother. She said, Grandma, why is bread so important? I mean, you treat it like it's gold. And she said, bread is life. Bread is life. This is what kept us alive during the war. And then she said, but then why did you give bread to the Germans, the German prisoners of war? And she said, because we pitied them, but not the pity of what we have towards a sick dog or something like that. The pity of a human filled with compassion. The pity that says, I want to help you. I want you to live. I love you. That's the Russian soul. That's the Russian soul. Could you imagine Americans doing that? Could you imagine how we would treat people who came into our country and burned our villages down, stuffed it full of the women and children before they set them on fire, slaughtered people? Could you imagine? I mean, look, you probably can't imagine because probably every day you're filled with the need to have compassion to people like me who don't understand, you know, the but so yeah, you guys probably understand it better than most, the need to have compassion against people that deserve your hate. But the Russians have compassion. They have forgiveness. They are literally, you know, I don't want to bring religion because that'd be hypocritical. I'm not very religious, but they are, you know, I would imagine that if Jesus had a message, it would be to forgive. I think that was his message, to forgive, to love. Love thy neighbor as thyself and show thy neighbor peace. That's the Russian motto, baby. That's what they do. And you would go over there and you would just be, holy beep, these guys are awesome. Now, how do we do that? How do we bridge that gap? Because today this country is gripped with Russophobia. We are trained from the very moment we wake up till the very moment we go to bed to hate the Russian people, to hate the Russian government, to fear them. And, you know, why do we fear them? Fear is derived from ignorance because we don't know them. We don't understand them. We have to take the time to get to know these people, and we have to give them the opportunity to know us. Because, frankly speaking, we better pray that they pity us. And I don't mean the pity of a superior to an inferior, but they pity us as human beings who are deserving of compassion, warmth, and humanity, so that they will work with us to make a better world once this is all done. Because, my God, what we have done to these people, what we have done to them, we just go back to those casualty figures. There are Russian mothers, there are Russian wives, there are Russian daughters that are losing their men every single day in numbers we can't even begin to imagine. We had better beg their forgiveness, beg their humanity, beg their compassion, and pray that they're not like we are. Because if we win this war, I can guarantee you, we would not be reaching out a helping hand to the Russians to help pick them up. They will reach out a helping hand because they're that kind of people. And I say it's because I trained to kill these guys. I really did. When I was a Marine, my sole focus, I joined the Marine Corps to kill Russians. I was a child of the Cold War. I graduated high school in 1979. I graduated high school in West Germany. That was the front lines of the Cold War. I literally go to Berlin and look at the Soviet soldiers and say, how can I kill them? I want to kill them. Kill a commie for mommy. People joke about it. It was real. Better dead than red. You're damn right. Communism was the threat. We were propagandized from day one. I joined the military to close with and destroy the Russian enemy through firepower and maneuver. I trained for 2.5 years in 29 Palms to do that job. And if there was a war, I would have been very good at it. Thank God they didn't give me that opportunity. Instead, they sent me to the Soviet Union as a weapons inspector to implement the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty to get rid of nuclear weapons that were threatening the entire world with imminent destruction. And while I was there implementing this treaty, I had a chance to meet the Russian people. So when I talk about the Russian people, I'm not talking about it from school learning or hypothetical, you know, expansion. I'm talking about firsthand experience. I was invited into the home of a Russian weapons engineer who had turned into the guy who was helping us implement this treaty. I trained to kill him. He had trained to kill me. And yet on New Year's Eve, 1988, he invited me and three other inspectors into his home. Now, you guys know this. When everybody's gone through this. You're going to invite somebody in your house, you clean it up, right? Because you don't want them to see the real you. You know, real you ain't pretty. Trust me, if I spun this camera around, you'd be going, oh, my God, Scott, fix that. That's dirty. Get that up. Hell, I got three dogs, man. This house is a mess. But if you were going to come in, I'd clean it up because I'm trying to put a good face on. And I can do that because in America, we didn't have bigger homes. In Russia, they have very small apartments. Very small apartments, very compact. And so when they invite you in, it's one of the most intimate things a Russian family can do, to bring you into their home, because you are seeing laid out in front of you their reality, everything about them. There are no secrets. And he invited me and three Americans into his home and broke bread with us and shared his life with us and opened up. And this is a man that I had one time said, I want to kill this guy. And I suddenly found out that he is a loving husband. I met his wife. They love each other. Imagine that. Russians loving each other. Geez, you didn't hear that on the evening news. He had children that they loved. They doted on, just like we dote on our children. They wanted the best for their children. They had dreams for their children. They laughed at jokes, good and bad, because they're polite people. When I would tell my jokes, they would laugh because my jokes were pretty bad. They invited their neighbors into the house, and I got to meet them too. I mean, my heart broke that night. Broke with love, but also broke that I had spent 2.5 years trying to kill these people. And, you know, God, we need to come back to that. We need to find a way to catch. If there was a red pill, I mean, you guys are the red pill diaries, but if there was a red pill or blue pill or purple pill that you could capture that in, I would bottle that stuff and send it to every American to pop it in so that we could be imbued with this love, with this humanity for these people. And yet, we're promulgating policies that are killing hundreds of their men every single day. My heart breaks. And it's Ukrainians that are dying too. I don't want to pretend that they're not. This is just one of the greatest modern day tragedies that the people can imagine. And yet most Americans are ignorant of it. They just read the headlines and they don't understand what war means and what the costs are. And because you don't understand the problem, you can't solve the problem. The solution is love. I don't mean to break that. The solution is love. The solution is humanity. And I'm afraid that the American people have lost the capacity to show that kind of love and humanity to others. We can't even show it to ourselves. I mean, I don't want to get too far a bridge here. I apologize for this. But if I walk out of my house 5 miles away in downtown Albany, there's homeless. There's homeless.
Yeah. I see.
And everywhere. I'm sure everywhere in America, you can see the same thing. If I walk down Clinton Avenue in Albany, it's the black ghetto. It's boarded up. It's not the same as the rest of the city. And I took my daughters there. We're dropping off some clothes to the Salvation Army. And they saw it as we drove through. This is when they were younger. They said, Daddy, what happened here? I said, nothing happened here, honey. I mean, this is reality. They said, but why are the buildings like this? I said, because nobody cares. They said, well, we care. I said, you're young. Wait till you become an adult and you find out how hard it is to care, to try and do something for the people of Clinton Avenue when the cops don't care, when the firefighters won't respond, when the politicians will ignore them and deny them money because they don't have the tax base. You know, America, we hate ourselves. So how can we possibly love the Russians? But if we're going to prevent a war, we have to learn how to love. And maybe the Russians can teach us to love. That would be nice. Maybe we could take a lesson from them. I apologize. I went off.
No. This is what the platform is for. We want you to speak your mind, get everything off your chest, because there are people that are listening that can feel what you're saying, and so, some will listen later that can feel what you're saying. But we have a question from Melbourne, from Australia for you, and it's from Mike Al-Hassan. He said, is there anything we can do to help lift off the sanctions on Syria specifically now after the devastating earthquake?
Oh my God. I mean, just think about that. We can't provide help to Syria because we've sanctioned them. And we're not providing help to Syria because we sanctioned them. Again, you know who is providing help to Syria? Russia. They've flown multiple airplanes in. They have their guys on the ground. Their soldiers are on the ground digging bodies out of the thing. Now, we have American soldiers in Syria. Why aren't we telling the Syrian government, hey, our guys are going to put their guns down, but we'd like to send them in. We'd like to send in this battalion to the city and help you dig things out. Can we build some tents? We have some medical people here. Well, let's build that up. Why aren't we doing that? Instead, our troops continue to steal oil and occupy illegally one third of the nation. If we were a nation that cared, our guys would put the guns down. You know what? We would win the hearts of the Syrian people doing that. Right now, the Syrians greet our patrols by throwing Molotov cocktails and rocks at us. Rightfully so. I'm not saying they're wrong. I'm just saying that's what they do. But, you know, I can guarantee you that if we went and we actually helped them dig people out of the ground, they wouldn't throw rocks and Molotov cocktails at us. Where they'd love us. They'd embrace us. They'd try. Because I haven't been to Syria, but I've been to the Arab world. I've been to Iraq. I've been elsewhere. And again, like the Russian people, these are human beings with hearts. They love. They do all the things that we don't give them credit for doing. But the United States could easily look. All the president would have to do today, literally right now, Joe Biden, all he'd have to do is say, I waive all sanctions until further instruction. They're all waived. Boom. Send everything in. Help these people. That's all that has to happen. He does not need congressional approval. He is the president of the United States, and he can order this to happen today. But the problem is, see, if we do that, we're going to get to know the Syrian people. The biggest risk to America's policy is to have Americans on the ground in Syria working with the Syrian people, learning the reality of Syria, and then they'll come back and say, why are we sanctioning them again? What's going on here? And we have to remain ignorant, because from that ignorance comes the fear that allows us to promulgate the policies that are currently in place. But, you know, the United States has the ability to save thousands of Syrian lives, and we're choosing not to.
Well, why is the United States so, and Europe, so loud over the territorial integrity of Ukraine, but they don't say a word about the U.S. in Syria? They don't say a thing about the U.S. ignoring the will of the Iraqi people, or they don't say anything about the Israelis, the U.K., or the U.S. in Yemen occupying strategic areas that are rich in resources?
Can I give you an honest answer?
Yes.
I don't want anybody to get mad at me. Guy's wearing a Raiders hat. He's going to kick my butt. the honest answer? What color are the Ukrainians?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, what color are the Iraqis? What color are the Syrians? What color are the Yemenis? Mm-hmm. I'm just being honest with you, okay? Because when most empowered Americans look at Ukrainians, because I can't say most Americans, because America's turning into a nation that is not exclusively white anymore, and that's a good thing. We ain't all white. You know? I mean, that's just the reality. I'm okay with that. I can't say they look like all Americans, but empowered Americans, Americans who still have the mechanism, and most empowered Americans are white. I mean, that's just the God's honest truth. And when they look at the Ukrainians, they see people who look like us, white people. But when we look at Iraqis, they don't look like us. They're brown. And we still have the ability to dehumanize people of color. We still have the ability to pretend that people of color don't feel like we do, care like we do, value life like we do. And that's the honest approach, because I can guarantee you right now, if Yemen was actually, I don't know, Kosovo, we'd be behaving a little bit differently, a lot differently, because we're not going to promulgate policies that impact white people the way we do. I mean, my God, can we, again, no humanity. Do your hearts not break when you see the Yemeni children? Yours do, I'm sure. Mine does. But most people will look at it and go, no, they're not like us. They're not like us. They're used to, I mean, God, I've heard this before. They're used to that. Really, a mother's used to her child starving to death in her arms. There ain't no mother in the world that's used to that. And there shouldn't be a mother in the world that's used to that. And when you say that, you're just exposing your racism, your prejudice, the fact that you have no soul, no soul whatsoever. So that's the honest answer. I mean, I can get into geopolitical answers. We can talk about the history of how lines were drawn on a map and all this stuff, the old colonial aspects of it. And I mean, you know, so, you know, some PhD, some doctors got there going, Ritter's oversimplifying the problem. I am. But it's also the most honest answer you're going to get.
Before we get back to the China and the Russia situation with the United States, I want to ask you something pertaining to the U.S. national security. Now, we often hear them trumpet that U.S. interests are around the world. But what is more important than at home? He who defends everything defends nothing. And if you are spending $100 billion on a war in Iraq, well, while there are thousands of bridges that are in disrepair at home, you see city after city going bust. You see community after community begging and pleading for the government for some aid. And every time they're on the slash, they're on the budget getting slashed because they're saying that, oh, we can't find money for this, but we can find money for a $1 trillion warplane that doesn't really work, and we can find money to prosecute and persecute another war of choice, and we can always get that emergency funding. Why can't the government, or why won't the government do that for the people within their own borders? And if and on top of that, isn't that a sign of contempt to the population of America?
Yeah. Of course it's a sign of contempt. Let me put it this way. Flint, Michigan. How long have they had bad water? A long time.
Yeah.
They still have bad water because it's too expensive. Because it's hundreds of millions of dollars. Yeah, maybe a couple billion dollars. And oh, that's just, you know, all the Republicans, we aren't going to give that kind of money. That's social welfare. That's this, that. And the Democrats are, well, we have other priorities. Da, 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 da. It means you don't care about the people of Flint. Bottom line, zero. And you want to know why we don't care about the people of Flint? Because they look like you. They don't look like me. They look like you. And you're used to bad water. You're used to that. They don't really care. It's all political. It's a game. It's this. Oh my God, if I were the people of Flint, I would just say, you don't care about us. And that's the truth. If I was the people of America, I would recognize that my government doesn't care about me. You know, we can't afford to fix Flint, but we can sign instantly a $45 billion military aid package to a neo-Nazi regime in Ukraine. I mean, the speed at which we're able to generate military funding for Ukraine is ridiculous. There's no debate. There's no accounting. I mean, my goodness, I'd love to be an organized crime guy and get in the middle of this because I'd be making so much money because there's literally no accounting. There's just $100 billion flowing out and they're saying, do with it as you wish. And the Ukrainians are going, you guys do know we're the most corrupt nation on the planet. Yeah, well, here's $100 billion. But I just want to remind you, we are the most corrupt nation on the planet. Yeah. So don't come back when you find out that 7 out of every $10 you send end up in my pockets and don't go to where you want it. Don't come back wagging the accusatory finger, because that's what's happened. Now, why can't we generate that funding to fix Flint? We could have fixed Flint that quick. We could fix any problem in America that quick if we applied that kind of money. Here's the problem. Americans have been trained to believe that national defense is about the military. Man, there's no reason to have a military if that which you are defending isn't worthy of being defended. Mm-hmm. Okay, people need to understand that the military is the last priority. When you want to talk about national defense, this is how I break down national defense. First and foremost, we have to have a healthy people. So if we're not providing for the health care of our people, then we have failed in national defense. Second of all, we have to have an educated people. If we're not providing for education for all, equal opportunity for all to become educated so that they can integrate themselves into this modern society that is technologically advanced, every aspect of it. Farmers don't need education. Have you taken a look at modern farming? Have you taken a look at how complex it is now to grow crops and the knowledge you have to have? There is nothing today that can be done based upon just rolling up your sleeves and giving it the old American try. Nope, you got to have brains. You got to be educated, and we have to make sure everybody is educated. Infrastructure. We have got to have bridges that aren't going to collapse. We have to have roads that don't have potholes. We have to have airports that can bring in traffic, leave traffic, and not leave people embarrassed when they come out. Fly into JFK sometime. It's an embarrassment. Land in Shanghai, and you'll say, oh, my God, what are the Chinese doing right? Take a train in America, then take a fast train in China, and you're going, there is something wrong. We're the greatest country in the world, and we have infrastructure like this, garbage, trash. Take care of those three things. I want a healthy people, an educated people, and I want infrastructure that works. And then I want to build a military that's capable of defending that. But that's my priority. And the military, notice what I said, the military capable of defending that.
Yes.
Not a military capable of projecting power around the world to take other people's resources, but a military capable of defending healthcare, education, infrastructure, the American people. And that should be the only purpose of the American military, to defend us against threats from abroad. But I would like to spend more money on diplomacy. Again, rather than spend $1 trillion modernizing our nuclear forces, the triad, you know, are Americans really this stupid? They roll out the B-21 Raider bomber. Raiders, it's the B-21. It's great. It's awesome. It's look at how sexy it is and sleek it is. And all Americans go, ooh, that's nice. Do you know that for the price paid for one of these bombers, you could solve a lot of problems? Education, healthcare, infrastructure. That bomber is useless. That bomber shouldn't exist. There's no reason to have that bomber. That bomber doesn't defend us. That bomber offends the rest of the world. The same thing with the F-35. It doesn't work, first of all. The B-21 is probably not going to work. You know, we have missiles. The sole purpose of these missiles in these silos, they will tell you, the only reason why we have missiles in silos is to attract enemy nuclear weapons. It's a missile sump. It's designed to create targets for nuclear weapons. Now, if you're the American people living next to that missile silo going, really? Really? That's what you want? You're going to turn my farm, my city, into a sump for enemy missiles? I don't like that. Let's not do that. I'd prefer the enemy isn't targeting my hometown. So if that's the only reason for this silo to exist, let's get rid of the silo. And we have submarines out there right now that have more destructive power on them. One submarine can destroy the world. One submarine can destroy the world. One submarine can destroy the world. And yet we don't care. We don't think about it. We need to wake up to the fact that our military, we spend, let's again, break this down. Russia's in the process of mobilizing a military that's capable of defeating NATO if they want to. Russia spends about $66 billion a year on defense. We spend over $800 billion. NATO together spends $1.1 trillion. Russia spending $66 billion can build a military that can defeat an alliance that spends $1.1 trillion. Do you not understand how broke we are? So we have to fundamentally change our relationship with the military. Look, I was a Marine. I'm very proud of being a Marine. And I like the training they gave me. I like the code that was imparted on me, integrity, honor, duty, etc. And I think there's a role for Marines today. But Marines can't be used as an expeditionary force to impose America's will on the world. That's not how neighbors operate or should operate. We should have diplomats out there who are talking to the Russians. We should be spending so much money on diplomacy so that we never have a conflict. Like, we could have solved all the problems that led to the Ukrainian war had we spent $30 million in diplomatic effort. I want American people to chew on that number for a little bit. For $30 million of diplomatic effort, we could have stopped a war that's already cost us over $100 billion. It's cost Ukraine $1 trillion in infrastructure damage. It's cost the world several $1 trillion in energy costs because of the sanctions that were imposed. So a little bit of yak, yak, yak. You can get irritated at it. Trust me, Your audience is probably tired of hearing me talk. But you know what? How many people have died because of yak, yak, yak? Not a single one. Bang, bang, bang kills a lot of people. Yak, yak. So I want people to be yak, 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 and I want them across the table. I want them to get frustrated. I want them to be drinking coffee. I want them to have to go pee several times a day because of the coffee they drank. I want them to get fat from eating these ridiculous diplomatic lunches. That's what I want because nobody's dying. What I don't want is for the diplomats not to be talking, and then we send these militaries off to fight and die in a battlefield, bringing so much pain and suffering and destruction and death. I mean, that's bad, but we have to train ourselves to think that way. We have to understand that a nation built on principles of love, compassion, and humanitarianism relishes the yak, yak, yak and condemns the bang, bang, bang. But we're the other way around. We put the bang, bang, bang on a pedestal. We're like, that's it, man. That's what we want. The nobility of the military. There ain't nothing noble about dying, people. There ain't nothing noble about dying, and there's nothing noble about taking human life.
And former Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi and current Foreign Minister of the Russian Federation, Sergei Lavrov, they run circles around all of these other Western diplomats, and they make them look like children on an international scale.
Yeah, because they're yak, yak, yak. They've mastered the art of yak, yak, yak. They do it quite well.
Yes. But what do you think of this? And I'll let Rashid chime in just a second. But what do you think this build up, everything is like building up to in the Ukraine situation? Where do you think this is leading NATO? Because, you know, we have a buildup of Russian and Belarusian forces in Belarus, and we have Poland trying to build up a second army or something. And then we have the belligerence of the UK. And I remember hearing you say something about you can put the entire UK military in a soccer stadium and still have 40,000 seats. But the belligerence of the UK and the unbridled bloodlust of these people like Kagan and Victoria Nuland, who runs U.S. policy, where do you think this is going? Because Russia is not going to stop until they accomplished what they set out for.
Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, let's just say that we can't use as a premise the notion that a nation isn't going to stop unless they get what they want as a reason to not oppose them. If Russia was in the wrong, I'd be saying we got to stop them. We can't allow this to happen. But Russia's on the right side of history. We're on the wrong side of history. NATO. Rashid with the Raiders hat. Is that, I think you told me last time, is that Oakland or Las Vegas Raiders?
Los Angeles.
Los Angeles. Oh, my goodness.
Los Angeles.
Okay. Los Angeles. But when L.A. played in Los Angeles, how many people could the stadium hold?
92,000.
We could put the entire British military in that stadium and have 20,000 unsold seats. All right. So just think about that. So the British are sitting there talking big. They ain't big. They got nothing. And the 70,000 guys they have, they're not combat ready. I mean, you know, they can generate maybe two brigades worth of troops, but those troops don't have any tanks, anything that works. The British don't have a functioning military right now. Simply don't have it. You asked, what about NATO? I just told you about NATO. The British, who are big about, you know, wearing their uniforms with their medals and looking good, they don't have an army. How about them Germans, you know, the bratwurst-eating Germans? They're all fat, happy, ready. They can't fight. Their troops can't get out of the barracks. They don't know how to fight. They don't have equipment that works. They have an air force that's on the ground, can't fly because they don't maintain it. Why? Because they've been cutting their budgets. And so, you know, Germany's sitting there going, we're going to give tanks to Ukraine. Yeah, but you got other guys in Germany going, don't. We don't have any tanks, guys. We got nothing. The stuff you're giving them is in a warehouse. It doesn't work. We're going to have to bring it up to speed. But the tanks that work that you want to give them, we can't build new ones because, thanks to America, We can't afford to do it anymore. The price of steel is out of this world. We can't build new tanks, so everything you give away, we can't replace. We make ourselves weaker. The Germans cannot generate a division of troops capable of projecting power outside of their country. They are pathetically weak. The same thing with the French. Can't do it. NATO can't do anything. Poland has 165,000 troops. Most of them are conscripts. They're not professors. They're not well-trained. They're not well-equipped. They want to create a 300,000-man army. Russia just mobilized 300,000 guys. So, you know, really, Poland? And Russia, because of all this, has taken their military and decided to expand it to 1.5 million people. They're building new divisions. They're equipping them with the best equipment. Their defense industry is out there cranking stuff out on a daily basis. We don't have anything going on. So NATO is fundamentally broken. It is a paper tiger, literally a paper tiger. It is a nothing burger. They can talk about NATO this, NATO that. It is a joke. The only force in NATO that's capable of fighting is the United States, but there's not enough of us anymore. We have 100,000 troops in Europe right now, but those aren't 100,000 screaming memes on the front line ready to hook and jab. There's maybe 40,000 of those guys. Everybody else is in a support structure, support function. During the Cold War, when we're going up against the Soviet group of forces, which was about 400, 500,000 troops in East Germany, we had about 250,000 American troops, 250,000 deployed in Germany already, and we were going to reinforce them with another 300,000 so that we could have a little bit more than 500,000, half a million troops ready to fight, a half a million. We don't have any more troops. We have 100,000 in Europe right now, and there's not any way we can get more troops there, and if we could, we couldn't sustain them. Artillery. The Russians right now, this is an artillery war. They enjoy about a 10-to-1 advantage on most parts of the front. Some places where the Ukrainians have beefed up their forces, the Russians have maybe a 6-to-1, 7-to-1 advantage. That means for every one Ukrainian gun, there's 6, 7, or 10 Russian guns. The same thing with the United States. We don't do artillery. We don't do artillery at all. Our armored brigade has 18 artillery pieces attached to it. One battery. What are we? The Russians have thousands of them. So we're going to go to war against the Russians. During the Desert Storm, the war that I participated in, we fired 60,000 rounds for the entire conflict. The Russians fire 60,000 rounds in one day. Think about that. One day. We will run out of artillery ammunition and sustained artillery duels with the Russians in 1, 2, 3 days. We're out. No more. We don't even make it anymore, not in the numbers we need. The Russians, on the other hand, will just keep firing 60,000. And I have to tell you, in an artillery duel where you're firing nothing and they're firing 60,000, you're going to lose. So, you know, we can't fight a war with Russia. We can't. We don't have the ability. And we're fooling ourselves and we're fooling everybody into thinking we can. Don't look at an American soldier in his nice little uniform in Germany saying, I am bold, I am brave, and I am going to do this job. He can't. If he was honest, he would say, please don't send me to war because all the guys that I love, all the guys and gals now, because women are in the military too, on frontline combat units, they're all going to die. And that's the God's honest truth. If American troops go to war in Europe today, they will all die. We can't win. This is wrong. Now, people can say, but we're America. Yes, we are. Can't we build up our military? I don't know. You want to spend more than the $880 billion a year that we're doing? Didn't we just tell you that Flint needs clean water, that Albany needs Clinton Street cleaned up, that America is fundamentally broken? Now you want to spend more money to do what? To play, and I've got to watch what I say again, but how do I say this without insulting anybody? Just a game of comparison. Okay, a game of comparison that we're going to have a comparison contest with the Russians. That's what we want. We want to spend all this money so that we can, hey, look, no, guys, that's not how this works. Take care of the home front first. This is a conflict we don't need. Germany doesn't need to spend 100 billion euro to refurbish its military. NATO doesn't need to bankrupt itself to build up a military to do what? Match the Russians? We don't need to do this either. We need to learn how to peacefully coexist with Russia. That's our number one goal and objective. And if we can do that, then we can save an awful lot of money and turn to the problems here at home in the United States, and Europeans can turn to their many problems in Europe. And maybe we can learn to have, you know, the kind of idyllic life that we all aspire to, that we'd like to have, you know, where we wake up in the morning, free from fear. You know, Roosevelt talked about that, you know, the four freedoms, Gosh, that's what we need, guys. We need to be free of fear of hunger, of violence. We don't need to be encouraging the four horsemen of the apocalypse to come riding down on us. We need to be doing something different than what we're doing right now. But NATO's broken. That's the short answer to your question. NATO's broken. It ain't going to be fixed.
Go ahead, Rashid.
Seymour Hersh yesterday saying that the Nord Stream 2 pipeline was just done with the Buy America. What do you think about that?
Let me answer this way, because you know there's that the old thing that you got to have truth in advertising. And so, in the interest of full disclosure, I am a good friend of Seymour Hersh. We have been friends for 25 years. He kicks my ass, and I said a bad word. He kicks my butt.
No, and, you can say that here. You can say that here.
Okay, I apologize. I've been trying to keep this family friendly. But you know, he beats me in golf. If I played tennis, he would beat me. He's just a really, really good guy. I honestly mean that. He's good people. But the way I met him is he was doing his investigative journalism on me. And I have had a lot of people investigate me and write about me. And there's very few that do it with integrity, because the temptation is to take the narrative that's offered you by the power structures and run with that, because those are the guys that butter your bread. Scott Ritter doesn't butter anybody's bread. You don't make money off telling the truth about Scott Ritter. Seymour Hersh told the truth, and he earned my respect in doing that. He's a guy who literally runs down all of his sources. He facts checks it. He's not perfect. None of us are. But there's a reason why he's considered to be the legendary reporter that he is, because he does a good job. And I've basically ruined my voice. I've been getting too emotional with you guys. But let me fix this. Okay, I'll just calm down a little bit. Seymour Hersh writes it, you can believe that he believes it to be correct, that his sources have been double-checked, triple-checked. And I say that because people need to take this article seriously. You know, we have the U.S. government saying no, don't believe it, it's not true. If you're at the stage today where you believe anything the U.S. government says about anything, you've got some big problems. The fact that the U.S. government is denying this story the way they have tells you that Hersh is on to something. But the ramifications of what he's reporting are stunning. The United States basically declared war on Germany, on Europe. So did Norway. Norway did it so they can open up a pipeline to replace the oil or the natural gas that they blew up, helping America blow up. This is the truth. And it's not just the United States now has to wake up to the fact that we went to war. We carried out an act of war against our German allies. Germany needs to wake up to the fact that America attacked us. I mean, this was an economic Pearl Harbor. It's a surprise attack. And Seymour Hersh's article lays it out in with facts and details that weren't previously available, that should expose to everybody what happened. I hope I encourage everybody to read Seymour Hersh's article and support him on Substack, because you know he used to be one of the premier writers for the New York Times and the New Yorker magazine. Stuff he wrote was just it was there. But then he got deplatformed because they didn't want to tell the truth. The truth was inconvenient. The government put pressure on them, and so they deplatformed him. And, the world is a much lesser place without Seymour Hersh, going out there and hunting down the truth. And the fact that Seymour Hersh has decided to come back and share this truth with us via Substack means we owe it to him to support him. He hasn't asked me to say this. I'm just saying it on my own. His is a voice that needs to be heard. And thank goodness we have someone like Seymour Hersh out there doing this job.
Now, when we look at the situation that is happening in Ukraine and we see America unhinged, that she'll go to any length to try to push her goals through on everyone. What do you think the situation will be like if she continues to push China over Taiwan? And we look at Russia's manufacturing, her military industrial complex, but that pales in comparison to what the Chinese can do. So what do you think the outcome would be if America continues to push the Chinese over Taiwan?
Let me put it this way. We talked about FAFO before. Okay, with Russia, that's small letters. Small F, small A, small F, small O. With China, it is capital letters, 48 font, bold. FAFO. All right? That's what's going to happen here. You know, but the good news is the Chinese don't want a war with America or Taiwan. They're looking for a peaceful resolution. The bad news is America seems to want a war. I mean, we have a general, you know, in the lead up to the Gulf War, there was a general, I think his name was Dugin. I'm old, I'm getting senile, so you got to forgive me. But General Dugin was an American Air Force general. He was the Air Force component commander of the forces getting ready to fight Iraq. And he spouted off at the mouth about, you know, the air campaign. And he was fired on the spot because they said, you aren't empowered to do that. It's not your job. Your job is to implement the orders we give you, not to opine on things publicly. You're not a policy maker. You're a policy implementer. We have a Air Force general, four-star general named Minahan. He commands, I think, Air Mobility Command. These are the guys that fly, you know, the big logistics aircraft and all that, cargo planes. And he came out and published a paper where he said, he believes we're going to go to war with China in 2025. He believes. Dude, you don't get, if you believe it, keep it to yourself. You don't have a right to write this down. It's not your job. He should have been fired. And then he told all of his Air Force pilots and logistics guys to go get their pistols and fire a clip. P.S. General, if you qualified on a pistol, you'd know that it's called a magazine. You don't call it clips. Clips is what Hollywood people call it, but it's a magazine. But fire a clip and empty all the rounds at the head. Oh, General, when we qualify, we don't empty rounds at the head. We actually shoot center mass right here, you see, because that's how you kill people. You shoot for the head, smaller target. You might miss. Then they get the fire back and they kill you. So, you know, he obviously doesn't know anything about anything, but he's opining about it. It got picked up in the media and there, and yet he's still the general. He's still there. It's irresponsible. We have other generals talking about how we're going to attack mainland China to disrupt their logistics if they ever invade Taiwan. We have other generals talking about how our Navy can do the job. Actually, it was admirals talking about that. But my point is, we are very belligerent, very belligerent. And the Chinese are sitting there looking at us going, hey, guys, every year you run a war game about this conflict, you know, in Newport at the Naval War College. Why don't you go ask them how the war games end up? Oh, we lose all the time. Imagine that. In fact, the only time we win is when we cheat. I mean, I don't know if you guys are computer gamers, you know, but I have, my daughters have friends. They're of the age where they play certain games. And I guess you can get, like, they call it a hack or something. I don't know, where you can, you get in, like, if you need gold, you can get a hack where you cheat and you get yourself more gold so you can artificially skew the game so that things, good things happen to you and not bad things. Life ain't a computer game, guys. Generals, you don't, there's no hack out there where you get to go give America better capabilities so that we can win the war game. No. You go to war with what you have, and what you have is insufficient to the task. We have a Navy whose doctrine, whose methodology is derived from World War II, back when big fleets were a thing. Big fleets are no longer a thing because there's hypersonic missiles that can reach out and touch your ship before your ship gets anywhere near the shore. And we don't have the ability to shoot those hypersonic missiles down. So all these great Navy ships we have, the aircraft carrier, Top Gun. I love the movie. I love Top Gun. I love Maverick. I name a dog after Maverick. Great movie, but it's Hollywood. Those aircraft carriers aren't going to get close enough. They're going to be sunk. They're going to the bottom. When they go to the bottom, 5,000 to 7,000 Americans go to the bottom with it. That's the truth. That's the whole truth and nothing but the truth. We don't have the military. We've been too busy living off of past glory that we haven't been thinking about, you know, A, what we would need to fight a war with China, and B, do we really want to fight a war with China? Because the other thing we have to understand is China has been doing global economy better than us. You know, Biden went to the G7 and said, we have to compete with them Chinese. You know, they've been doing that Belts and Roads Initiative thing, going out there and developing infrastructure around the world. So we're going to compete with a Build Back Better world plan, because, I mean, Build Back Better works so back good here in America. Flint, Didn't work, President. You've been lying through your teeth like all presidents do. You don't care about the American people. You only throw words at us. You don't give us what we need, which is the money and the policies necessary to make meaningful change. But now you're trying to convince the world that to spend $600 billion to compete with the Chinese, who in the last several years have spent between $6 and $10 trillion. I mean, anybody here do fantasy football? You know, you get some money, right? And you get to go out and buy your players, and you get to pick players to perform, and then you hope they do well in the game. You can't predict that, but if you spend enough money to get a player that has a history of performance, odds are they're going to do well. So could you think that you could compete in fantasy football with, let's say, a side that had, in game terms, a $60 million budget to go out and buy the players, all the players they want, and you're going to fight them with, I don't know, $60,000. Okay, so you got 60 grand to go out. You couldn't even afford a scrub like me, okay, to be on your team. And I can guarantee you in fantasy football, if I was one of your players, you would get no points. But that's what the United States is doing. We're going to get the world to spend $60 billion to compete with the Chinese, who have spent between $600 billion against $6 and $10 trillion already sunk. That's not what they're talking about spending. They've already spent it. They have the team. You got nothing. And you know what happened to that $600 billion province? Nothing happened. Why? Because it's all words. We never followed through. It didn't happen. The war came. The sanctions came. The energy crisis came. And none of that material is manifest. None of that money is manifested. They did a couple of little investments here and there, which the Chinese don't care. And now, we want to go and enter an economic conflict with these guys who dominate global supply chains. You remember we couldn't get enough trucks down to the ports to get the stuff out of the ports in Long Beach, and we had the supply crisis here, and prices went up, and all the kids were crying at Christmas because they weren't going to get to have little Sally poop doll or whatever toy that they thought was great. Well, geez, let me tell you what happens. That was a case of too many containers, not enough trucks. What happens when you have too many trucks but not enough containers? I mean, and yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, that's what will happen the moment we have an economic war with China. There will be no containers because everything is made in China. Everything. Even the stuff that says made in the USA was probably made in China and somebody just sewed made in the USA on it. Or it has Chinese components. Everything is made in China. And that's not a bad thing. Because if you think about it for a second, we go back to one of the earlier phases of our conversation where I talked about America being a consumer nation and we like to consume things that we can afford. I mean, we all do it. You go to the store. Really expensive stuff, unless you're, you know, some superstar, you know, rapper or rock and roll guy, you don't have that kind of, or drug dealer. I don't know. People make a lot of money, politicians. If you got that kind of money, you can buy the expensive stuff, walk around with the bling and look cool. But for the most of us, we sit there and go, I'll take the cheap stuff because that's all I can afford. China makes a lot of cheap stuff. And some of it's good, some of it isn't. I don't care. That's your choice. You get to make that decision. But they make it, we consume it. If they stop making it or stop delivering it to us, we don't consume it, and then we're very unhappy people. We don't want to go to war with China because when we do, this entire economy shuts down. It's gone zippo. This is a very, very artificial economy. America is not as strong as we like to believe. And one of the key weaknesses we have is our absolute total dependence upon China and China's, you know, supply chains. We don't have anything to replace it. We saw that the hard way when we talked about Russian energy. I mean, you know, Joe Biden, he American politician, his lips move, he's lying. We are not going to buy Russian oil anymore. Really, Joe? Really? I don't know. Tell me about those Gulf Coast refineries, Joe. You know, the ones that are geared to the kind of oil that comes out of Venezuela, but we sanctioned them so we couldn't have that oil. So you didn't want to spend the billions of dollars necessary to re-gear that because there would have been a production pause. The price of gas would have gone up. The American people would have voted you out of office. So you went to the other oil that's compatible, but it happens to be produced by Russia. Mm-hmm. And we were buying hundreds of thousands of barrels of it. And then now we're saying we're not buying it, but we are. You see, we buy it because Joe Biden's a smart man. We allow him, the Russians, to sell that oil to the Indians. And then the Indians put it on a tanker and resell it to us. But it costs more. because we're good businessmen, really smart stuff, buying Russian oil. But we are buying Russian oil from the Indians, but we're going to pay two times more than we would have paid if we bought from the Russians to begin with, because we're not going to buy oil from Russians. Guys, we're buying oil from Russia. We're buying gas from Russia. We're buying energy from Russia. The whole world's buying it. Europe's buying it. We don't want to buy it, but we have to buy it. But we have to play political game here. So we do all that. The world can't function without Russian energy. Straight up truth. There is no alternative. And the world can't function without Chinese supply chains. And that's just the harsh reality of it.
You know, on something you were talking about with the Chinese, this is what Rashid and I were talking about on one of our previous shows. I don't think the average American understands the effects of a war, even an economic war with China, would be, because 93 to 95% of all goods on the shelves in the stores come from China. And if China sanctions you, then the stores go belly up, which means that now you not only are the stores closing down, but now you have unemployment. What about the ship, the trucks that bring the stuff? They have nowhere to bring stuff. They have no goods to bring. So then you have them unemployed, and then they have those trucking companies have to pay back their loans to the banks, which they'll default on, meaning that the bank will be left going belly up, and it's just a domino effect. And on top of all of that, China is the largest investor in the United States, the largest buyer of bonds, the largest manufacturer, the largest exporter, importer, and trade partner with the United States. So, the people in power must be lunatics, because there is no rational explanation to say, let me go pick a war with my lender, my manufacturer, my trade partner, and my investor when I am bankrupt without them. But I'm going to go stoke tensions and war fever over there. What is the rationale behind that? Because you cannot make sense of this.
No, you're 100% correct. And now you expect me to make sense of it. thanks for that. You say the most honest thing. You can't make sense of it. Scott, make sense of it. but challenge accepted. Here's the deal. The United States at the end of the Second World War, and unfortunately, this will probably be my last answer because I've got a commitment at 10:30, so I apologize. But at the end of World War II, the United States inherited a global community that was fundamentally broken, torn apart by the war, and I'm not going to say that everything was malfeasance. Sometimes we do good things. There was a time when we actually cared. And the Marshall Plan and other global reconstruction things were done to rebuild a world. But we also took advantage of this to rebuild a world that benefited us. We imposed our own economic system. We imposed you hear talk about the rules-based international order. And you hear a lot of people talk about it's the cornerstone of the Biden foreign policy. We're here to restore the rules-based international order. Well, the rules-based international order doesn't exist in the mind of anybody but the United States. We created these systems so that we could impose our rules on the world to our unilateral benefit. And that's okay. You know, we've all grown up in homes run by parents who imposed a rules-based order on us. Okay? That's just the same thing. Mom, pa get to decide what you do and don't get to do. Because you're children and they're raising you. So at the end of World War II, America was pretty much the parent raising the world. And we put a rules-based international order to help the world grow up. But then we also created a system, because most parents, when your kid turns 18, you're like, bye, go leave, fly the nest, leave, go forth to be an adult. Visit us in Thanksgiving, send us a card at Christmas, but leave. But no, America couldn't do that. We became the parents that wanted the kids to be down in the basement, forever dependent upon us. So we raised a world of adults who are living in the basement. Mom's a basement. And that's it. And that's what we like, because we can control them then. We were control freaks. But the world grew up, and a lot of people, except for Europe and Australia and Japan and South Korea, decided we don't want to live in mommy's basement anymore. We're adults. We want to fly the nest and we want to grow up. And we resent that because we're not in control anymore. China grew up. China isn't living in America's basement anymore. China is out there and they're succeeding. They're doing well. They're thriving. It's sort of what most parents would want of their children, to go out and thrive. In other nations, India is thriving. Pakistan's trying to thrive. Indonesia's trying to thrive. The whole world has said, we're adults now. When we come to the table, it's not as children sitting at the table with Papa America at the head of it. We come to the table now as equals. America's at the table because you're our equal. But it's a multipolar world right now. That's not the world America wants. We want a world where we dominate, where we dictate, where we control. A unilateral world where the American singularity, everything gravitates around it. What the rest of the world is starting to say is, no, it's a multipolar world where we all sit together as equals. The rules-based international order no longer applies. In fact, China and Russia have come straight out and said, we don't recognize them because it's nothing. There's nothing in international law. China and Russia have said, we want the law-based international order, and the law is derived from the Charter of the United Nations that has determined the legal framework in which all nations will live together in peace and harmony. And that's what they want. And that's in direct conflict with the rules-based international order. And so that's why we're doing what we're doing. We're holding on desperately to this last remnant of global power, this structure that, frankly speaking, the world doesn't want, and we can't enforce anymore. We can't impose our will. The rules-based international order is collapsing as we speak. That doesn't mean that America's going away. We're too big to fail. I mean, that's the truth. We're big. The world can't function without us. We are part of the world, but we are now going to have to become a team member. And that's very difficult for a nation like America because we're not, again, I don't mean to be, I love this country. I hope you guys know that this is my country. I love it. I love it. I was willing to give my life for it. I'm still willing to give my life for it. I want to fix this country. But I'm very critical of it because, you know, if you love something and it's not going well, you have to be honest about what's not going well about it.